Hello, and welcome to 5280's Behind the Stories. This is episode 7, and I'm your host, Jeff Van Dyke. Behind the Stories is a podcast about life in Denver and Colorado, and on this episode, we're talking about three recent stories that appeared in both the magazine and on 5280.com. Today, we're joined by 5280's digital strategy editor, Rianne Minardi-Morrison.
Hi.
Chris Walker, 5280's associate editor.
Hey.
And Robert Sanchez, 5280's senior staff writer.
Hey.
As always, we have a wide range of stories to cover today. And I wanted to start with you, Rianne. You worked on a package that appeared exclusively on 5280.com about dry January. And Chris and I were actually just talking yesterday, and it seems as if, even though dry January has been around for a while, it seems to have really taken off this year. And, I was wondering if that's in part because we're coming out of the pandemic, or is there another reason for that? Or any thoughts on why it seems to be bigger this year than maybe in years past?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So dry January is, I think, about 10 years old. And last year it was the highest year for participation that they've ever had. And then I just got an email this year is already surpassing 2022 by 259%. So I think it's just a trend that's continued to snowball. I think a lot of people maybe did kind of reconcile their drinking habits during the pandemic, and they're trying to make a change. And now there's so many people doing it that it's easy to find a friend to kind of keep you accountable. So
and resources like the package that you helped put together. Tell us about the components of that package.
Yeah, so another lucky reason that there's so many people participating is because there's so many more products, I think, out there now. So we actually have in the package a guide to how to excel at dry January in 2023, 5 local non-alcoholic beers to sip, 10 of the best places in Denver to order mocktails, and 5 ways to make non-alcoholic drinks at home that kind of go beyond your average club soda. And that one's led by a beverage manager at one of the local bars. So lots of great resources online.
That was one of the things that I was thinking about, and I appreciated that one especially because, you know, one of the things that I like to do, it's maybe feels a little more degenerate when I'm working from home, but, you know, is crack a beer or mix up a cocktail at the end of the workday when I used to get home from work. And I'm doing my own version of dry January this year. It's a little modified. I had done dry January pretty strictly the last couple of years. But I did find I missed that ritual of coming home and mixing up a margarita or whatever it is. And I made my own version. I'm sure I didn't make it, but I came upon, you know, fizzy water and a little bit of pomegranate juice. And it kind of scratched that itch for me. It felt a little special, a nice little reward at the end of the day. Are there other NA drinks, or is there stuff from the package that you can direct people to, or something in that vein that they could do other than an alcoholic cocktail or a glass of wine?
Sure. So there's a lot of options. So there are plenty of non-alcoholic spirits. You might have seen Seed Lip around. You can buy these at a liquor store or I think online in some places. And those kind of they can be the base for a cocktail that is a little bit more elevated than just your standard sort of like cranberry juice and club soda. And they add a little bit of herbalness, and there's a lot of fun flavors that you can really build upon. And then another tip that I really liked from the package is that just because your cocktail isn't alcoholic, you can still make it fancy. So there's things you can do, like add the sprig of rosemary, put it in your favorite fun tiki glass or whatever. So it feels like you're having an experience, like you said, so you're participating in the ritual.
A little more special than a can of LaCroix or whatever.
Right, exactly.
You mentioned the NA beers. I've tried a bunch of them. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, there's so many good ones, and I wish I had tried some more before this package came out, but I really like Hoplark. I think they might be in Boulder. Yeah. And they make hopped tea, hopped sparkling water. So it's kind of reminiscent of beer, but it's also sort of its own thing. So, if you're looking for more of a real beer experience, I like Groovy a lot. They make some excellent beers, and they also make, alcohol-free wine.
Oh yeah. I was just at Somebody People the other night, and they had an alcohol-free Prosecco or sparkling wine. I like one. It sounds a little bit like the one you mentioned. It's from Lagunitas, which is out in California, but it's the Hoppy Refresher. And again, it's just, it's clear, so it doesn't look like beer, but it gives, it's not sweet, which is kind of a nice change. All right. Other tips and tricks for folks who are trying to, you know, really stick to dry January.
Yeah, so I think now is the time where it can feel a little hard. We've been in it for a while, and you're kind of looking for some inspiration to keep going. But if you've been using one of your apps, I think those are great for keeping yourself accountable. If you've got a partner who is also doing Dry January, who can kind of commiserate with you or keep your spirits up, that's a great resource. And just stock up on all the great Colorado products. There's also some amazing kombuchas, there are CBD drinks that are really prevalent now, and like we just talked about, so many options for non-alcoholic beers and wines and everything. So don't lose heart, and just try to maybe reward yourself in other ways as the month goes on.
And it's cool because you can just do it at home, but also, like I mentioned, at somebody people I think you're starting to see more of these options on menus at restaurants too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do have the 10 of the best places to order mocktails in Denver. So if you're really looking to have a night out on the town, but you don't want to break your commitment this month, there are so many great options at some of the best bars, honestly, around town. Lady Jane and Adrift, Deviation Distilling even has some stuff going on. So there's so many fun ways to get out and still, you know, be alcohol free.
So I'm curious, what are some of these mocktails like? What do they include?
Sure. So I'm looking at the package right now. There's a beautiful, looks like a raspberry and blackberry drink with some aquafaba foam perhaps on it. It can be arranged. So some of them are fruit-based, some of them are more herbal, some of them are very complex. There's an option from the Tatarian, which is known for its, you know, really robust and rich cocktails. I think you can find something for any palate, really.
I think, do you think Dry January is good if maybe you have a friend who's a problem drinker and you haven't been able to kind of broach that subject with them and maybe team up, or do you find people are doing those kind of things too?
I would say, yeah, with so many people participating, I think there are people from all walks of life. And yeah, if you're worried about somebody, you know, maybe be their accountability partner. Just say, hey, I would really like to try this. You know, would you like to join me for a week or a sober weekend out on the town? And just kind of maybe start that conversation if they haven't been able to talk about it yet.
Thanks so much, Rianne. It does seem like there's a lot more sort of open dialogue about people's relationships with alcohol, and I think that's part of the reason that we're seeing this. I wanted to turn to you, Chris, and talk about your story about permaculture, which is, I'll be honest, something that I didn't know existed. If you could start by telling us a little bit about what permaculture is, and then we'll dive in a little deeper to the story that you wrote.
Permaculture, permaculture, permaculture. I'm going to try to give the clearest explanation that I can. It can both be very heady and practical. So in the heady sense, it stands for permanent culture. It was coined by these two Australians in the 1970s who were railing against industrialization and capitalism. They were trying to find ways that we can find sustainable practices as a society. So in practical terms, one of the ways that it's used most often is in agriculture and gardening. One of the main concepts is to look to nature to find clues for how to create sustainable environments, how to build resiliency, how to build a robust, in a gardening environment, a robust garden. And so it's instead of, you know, what you might see on a commercial farm where it's all monocropping, in a permaculture garden, you're going to see a wide variety of plants and species that work together that create this rich soil plant environment.
So Jerome Ozentowski is the pioneer of permaculture, like in America, or he's one of the more recent pioneers, and he lives up in Basalt?
Yeah, so I've heard about this guy for many years. There's this gardening guru on top of Basalt Mountain near Carbondale. He's grown bananas in Colorado, which is, you know, excuse the pun, just bananas. And so I've always been interested in doing a profile of this guy. He's known as a permaculture pioneer worldwide. He's not a founding father, but at least since the 80s, he's run the longest operating permaculture design course in North America.
Okay, and so you actually went up to Basalt to go meet with Jerome and tour his property.
I did meet with Jerome, and yeah, everyone just calls him Jerome. His property is absolutely amazing. I mean, you can just see his enthusiasm for gardening and for permaculture. And so as he's walking around and he's showing me how these, you know, vines interact with these understory plants, I mean, he just has such enthusiasm for what he's doing. People have mentioned him as like a plant whisperer. He almost is in this communion with plant life, as you can hear in this clip.
Every year we plant something new, and then what's there spreads. And I call it stream of consciousness gardening. And it takes on a mind of its own. It takes on an energy of its own. It's not something, we initiate it, but then it goes.
So you might be wondering how he got initiated into this. Jerome has a really interesting background. You should read the story if you want all the details, but the short of it is that he's a ski bum. He ended up in the Aspen area for skiing. He even has this story, which was pretty fun, about teaching Hunter S. Thompson how to ski. And so he found this property on Basalt Mountain because it was the cheapest property he could find anywhere in the Roaring Fork Valley. And he tried gardening initially. I mean, this is very nutrient poor clay on Basalt Mountain. Nothing grew. It's a harsh environment. And so he later ran into this permaculture design designer in Basalt who sort of showed him the ropes. And this was a case where, you know, the protege became the master. He started implementing these techniques up on Basalt Mountain, turning these greenhouses into thriving tropical environments. He also has a Mediterranean greenhouse. And so his property is just this cornucopia of all this plant life. It's really remarkable.
How big is the property?
It's very small. I mean, he has a 9-acre parcel, but most of it is sheer cliffs and, you know, very ragged hillside. So most of his property is kind of based on this half acre little section of land.
Okay. And so getting to that, there's this battle, if you will, over the property and the Central Rocky Mountain Permaculture Institute. And I know it's a little convoluted, but it was sort of some of the spine of your story. Tell us about that battle.
So pretty much everything on Jerome's property is unpermitted. It almost looks like a Mad Max type of compound. He even refers to himself as a prepper. So he's built all of these greenhouses out of scrap material. None of it is to code. None of it was consulted with the county whether he could build these things. And no one really cared or noticed for a long time.
Did this start in the 70s?
Yes. He started building these properties in the 70s. And so he's been up there a long time. And he's described by some of his students as a thistle, he's kind of prickly, which comes across even in interviewing him. So some of his relationships with his neighbors haven't been the smoothest. Getting up to his property is on this really treacherous road that you can't really pass other cars. So there's been all these grievances that have built up over the years. And so finally a neighbor complained about permitting on his property to the county. And for the first time, in 2019, it really got on Eagle County's radar, and this became a big problem for him. They had inspectors come out. Turns out that a lot of his stuff on his property didn't really fit within the zoning code of where he was, including the courses that he was teaching, because he's in a residential area. He's not zoned for education. And so the very sort of essence and lifeblood of his organization, Crimpy, got wrapped up in this zoning fight with Eagle County.
Okay, so some of his neighbors support him, some of them don't. Is that a fair way of assessing the situation right now?
That is a fair way of assessing it. His immediate neighbors are probably his most vocal critics. But one of the things that's incredible is, I mean, Jerome is something of an international legend. He's taught permaculture around the world. He has all these acolytes. He's taught literally thousands of students on his property. So at these county meetings, one of which I attended and others I watched, you had these incredible displays of support from dozens and dozens of people coming out of the woodwork, former students, former teachers in his program, and these really impassioned arguments that there should be a solution that allows him to continue. And I can play some of those clips from that meeting.
I truly believe that it is because of Jerome and Crimpy that we have a flourishing community of sustainable farmers in the Valley, again, many of whom are here today. The agricultural knowledge displayed in this demonstration farm is far too valuable for our local community and the world to simply be shut down.
We are facing climate change right now. We are facing increased food prices. Here is somebody that is solving that problem and is teaching folks, my God, help him survive. This is a critical thing to our future.
All due respect to the other homeowners, with just a little change in perspective, living in such close proximity to an international legend could be an asset.
The first meeting, there were 3 hours of testimonies in his favor. It was really remarkable to watch.
So where do things stand now, Chris?
So, as it happens, there have been delays and all kinds of bureaucratic maneuvering. It's been delayed, delayed, delayed. And so we're supposed to find out the result of all of this tonight. January 10th, 2023 is the final meeting on whether a special use permit, which is what he's applied for to allow him to continue operating, will be granted by Eagle County.
He's a fascinating guy, and that's a fascinating story. Thanks, Chris, and maybe we'll do an update on the pod in the future.
I'd love that. Thanks.
All right, turning to our last segment for this episode, Robert, I wanted to talk with you about your feature about millennials who have been leaving Denver and the metro area in high numbers because of the high cost of living in the city. The cost of living had become a frequent topic of conversation here well before inflation hit last year. Tell us a little bit about the impetus for wanting to do this story and to make the focus on millennials.
I think kind of the push for me to do it is I think we all know people, even with in our own magazine, who've really struggled to kind of find a, not necessarily a foothold, but kind of a path forward as millennials, kind of figuring out how to make, not just make ends meet, but then add in all these other things. You know, you might want to travel, and you want to have a child, maybe you want to do something else. And I think
save a little bit.
Yeah, save a little bit. I mean, hello, right? So you're looking at people who are kind of undergoing these transitions in their lives and kind of just looking around and kind of looking at the landscape and saying, wait a minute, this is so expensive. This is so expensive. This is so expensive. They look at their paychecks and they're saying, is this really the right place for me?
So the idea is that boomers are retired. Gen X is more settled. Millennials are kind of at that stage in life where they're really trying to figure things out. And these are people who, you know, either grew up here, like so many people ended up here, and they're wondering if Denver's a good fit anymore.
You and I are both Gen X, so we've had our kids, we've had the house kind of thing. So now you have these millennials who are in the same, who are now moving into this next stage. So they're between generally the ages of 26, 41, 42 years old. So they're trying to make these decisions of, you know, house or kid or vice versa. So what you have are these people who are looking at what is my future in the city, in the metro area. You're doing this hard math and you're taking a look at this and you're seeing these boomers, these Gen Xers, they're already set. They've already made their lives here. They already own their property. They already have their kids. They're already doing the school thing. And now you have these millennials who are, wait a minute, now these houses that I could have bought 10 years ago are exponentially more expensive. And oh, wait a minute, I want to have a kid, but I also don't want to work. And we're a two-income family, because we have to be if we want to have an expensive house in the city, because they're all expensive. And now they're looking at $2,000, sometimes even more, per month for daycare. So these are massive expenses that these folks, they've moved here to kind of create this awesome life in a wonderful state. And now they're looking and they're like, maybe Omaha would be cheaper.
And the folks you talked to were people who generally could live here. The question was more, do they want to live here? To your point, they can have a different quality of life in, say, Omaha or Indianapolis, but they don't have access to the Rocky Mountains.
It, definitely. And I actually found two people who show up on my story are Rachel and Yuri, and they just had a son. And Yuri is from France, and they moved to France. They relocated to France because they did the math, and they were paying $2,500 a month for their mortgage for their 1,100 square foot place.
Up in Sunnyside or?
West Highland.
West Highland.
And so they had that. And then Yuri and Rachel start looking online and they start applying for these daycares. And they're paying all this money just to get on waiting lists. They're not getting called back. And then the ones they were getting calls back, it was literally the same amount of money they would have spent on their mortgage. And Rachel one night was just like, this is crazy. We cannot keep doing this. And they would be considered upper middle class. But it reached a point for them that they said, this is not responsible for us to be doing this. And they wanted money. They wanted to be able to go to the mountains and hang out and ski. And they wanted to visit Rachel's family in Virginia and Yuri's family in France. And when they start doing the number crunching, you start kicking things out. And Rachel said, I don't want to just spend my life inside my house and sending my kid over to daycare, because that's what she was worried their life would become.
When you were talking with folks about this, did you find a through line in terms of a precipitating factor that may have led them, if it's a family or a couple, to really asking these questions of themselves?
It's interesting, the younger millennials I found, say between the ages of maybe like 26 and early 30s, it was really them looking around and saying, I don't think I can afford a house here. And that really scared them. But for some of the older millennials, it was either them planning on having a kid or just looking and saying, this isn't the right place for us because of the kind of financial expenditures that we'd have, again, because of daycare. So that's what I found was like the two biggest events were homeownership and daycare.
I just want to say real quick, as a millennial, I am thankful that you took such a nuanced look at this, because we've come a long way from, I think we all remember being criticized for buying too much avocado toast. And it was like, what are the millennials doing that they can't get their financial act together? And there are real struggles. Yuri and Rachel that you mentioned reminds me of two of my friends that moved to Spain for very similar reasons. I mean, she's a Spanish citizen, was having a child, but all those considerations around daycare, Yuri and Rachel could be any number of millennials in Denver.
Yeah, totally. And I appreciate you saying that, because some of the younger millennials I found, they talked to me and they were like, avocado toast, right? They're talking about that. And they're like, what a joke. And they're like, come and see how we're living. And one of the young women I talked to, she was like, my mom calls me and yells at me once a month and says, when are you moving back? Because this is not sustainable. And, you know, when one of the young women I met was from Iowa, and it's interesting with these millennials, too, with so many jobs online now and you can work remotely. Some of these millennials are finding that they came here for work, but then switched jobs maybe during the pandemic or immediately after the pandemic. And now they're working remotely for a company in California or Philadelphia or New York or Miami or something. And they're like, well, wait a minute, I don't have to stay here anymore. I can move somewhere else and still make a good living and work remotely from wherever I want to live. I can work in Cincinnati now.
The other piece to that point, Chris, is, and Robert, you talk about it in the story, but we haven't talked about it today, is the student debt load. You know, I mean, forget about avocado toast. If you've got, you know, $100,000 or $80,000 in student loan debts, that's going to affect what you can do in terms of childcare or a mortgage or rent.
And there are some surveys, too, that we're talking about, like how half of millennials are living paycheck to paycheck now. And then I think there was a Georgetown University survey that came out. It said like 2/3 of all millennials nationwide could not afford a catastrophic event in their life. like a massive medical bill. They couldn't survive that financially. And so you add into the fact that what the median home price in this, or median home sales in Denver is around like $645,000. I mean, that's very, very, very difficult for just anybody to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for your reporting on that piece, Robert. And I think with that, we've wrapped up the seventh episode of 5280's Behind the Stories. Thanks to Rhianne, Chris, and Robert for joining me for this episode. And be sure to check out 5280 Magazine on newsstands and 5280.com for other stories about life in Denver and Colorado. And thanks for listening. If you liked the episode, please leave us a rating or review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you again next time.